The following is a recording for Kate Kane with the American Hospital Association of Chicago on Friday, October 5th, 2018 at 1 o'clock p.m. Central Time. Excuse me, everyone. We now have all of our speakers in conference. Participation in this call is by express written invitation of the AHA only. Unauthorized participants and or any party that aids and abets such unauthorized participants may be subject to criminal and civil penalties under both state and federal law. Please disconnect from the call if the AHA did not expressly invite your participation. Please also be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. Throughout the presentation, feel free to type in any questions you have via the Adobe platform. We will also take questions later at the end of the presentation over the phone, and further instructions will be given then. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Ms. Kate Kane. Ma'am, please go ahead.
Thanks, Chelsea, and good afternoon or good morning, everyone, depending on your location. Welcome to the AHA section for Metropolitan Hospitals in partnership with our Hospitals Against Violence Initiative webinar. I'm Kate Kane, Assistant Director in our Field Engagement Division. Our webinar is part of a series of educational opportunities hosted by the section and Hospitals Against Violence on issues of interest to hospitals and health systems. As a reminder, our webinars and calls are free as part of our hospital membership in the AHA and the constituency section. And archived webinars may be found on our site at aha.org. So before we begin, let me just clear up a few housekeeping items. Let me give you an email address for Jamel Ola, who can assist you if you have any technical issues or need immediate support during the call. Jamel's email address is jola@aha.org. That's jola@aha.org. So if you have any questions or need information during the call, feel free to shoot Jamel an email. And then at the conclusion of our webinar, there will be an opportunity for questions, and we welcome your input. You can do this in two ways. You will have the opportunity to ask live questions and interact with our speakers through our operator, Chelsea, or you may also use the Q&A feature on your monitor. I think it's down in the right corner of your monitor. And you can enter a question at any time during the webinar. So without further delay, let's get started. We're so pleased to have with us today three faculty members from the Harborview Injury Prevention and Research Center. HIPRC is a worldwide leader in reducing the impact of injury and violence on lives through research, education, training, and public awareness. Our speakers today will be Dr. Monica Vavilala, Director of HIPRC and Vice Chair of Anesthesiology and Pain Medicine. She is also Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Washington. We will also hear from Dr. Frederick Rivara. Dr. Rivara is the Seattle Children's Guild Endowed Chair in Pediatric Research. He is also Vice Chair and Professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Washington. And finally, we'll hear from Dr. Ali Rouhani Rabar, who is the Associate Professor of Epidemiology in the School of Public Health at the University of Washington and the Violence Prevention Section Leader at HIPRC. Let me now turn the call over to Dr. Vavilala.
Good morning, everyone, or good afternoon. We're very excited to be here today, and thank you, Kate, for inviting us to participate in this webinar. I'm just trying to find my mouse to advance the slide, which I have right here. Great. So what I'd like to do during my portion is really introduce you to the HIPRC, talk a little bit with you about our relationship with Harborview Medical Center, who we are, what we do, and why we think we contribute to reducing the violence and injury burden across the country. So the Injury Center was formed in 1985, and we are located at the Harborview Medical Center campus, so just across the street from our Level 1 Adult and Pediatric Trauma Center. We're very closely related to the mission of what the Trauma Center does. We work to address problems of injury across the lifespan. And our mission is so aligned to reduce the impact of injury and violence on people's lives through research, education, training, and public awareness. And we have a very strong partnership with the Trauma Center, with the Trauma Center leadership, and in fact, the Trauma Center supports us for the work that we do. So we're sponsored by UW Medicine and Harborview Medical Center in equal partnership. And this is really important to us because it really sends a message of cooperation, collaboration between the Academic Medical Center and the School of Medicine and King County, which owns Harborview Medical Center. We're structured in a way that achieves our goals. We have certain areas of focus based on the public health need in the region as well as our expertise among the faculty and practitioners. And so our main focus areas involve injury care. So we do work that addresses care of the injured person from the pre-hospital area to in-hospital to rehabilitation. That area of work is led by a trauma surgeon, Sam Arbabi. We do work in a number of countries here, including Ghana, Vietnam, Cambodia, India, Peru, and that body of work is also led by a trauma surgeon, Charlie Mock. Traumatic brain injury constitutes a substantial amount of work that we do here at the center, from injury prevention to care of adults and kids with traumatic brain injury. I lead that effort. Violence prevention is led by Ali Rouhani, who's going to be speaking to us today. And safe and active transport is that work that addresses marijuana and driving, elderly driving, auto pedestrian injuries. That work is led by Dr. Bessie Bell from the Department of Pediatrics. We also have work that is being done in the area of opiates and suicide prevention. And what's very unique about our injury center is that we are interdisciplinary. We do research, education, training, and outreach. The 30-year impact of the center has resulted in transformative work to reduce injuries from pajamas that were set on fire. We've participated in efforts that have really led the efforts on setting national highway speed limits. Bicycle helmet laws were passed largely in efforts led by Fred Rivara here, who will be speaking after me. Seatbelt and child passenger restraint laws that impact the majority communities, but also work has been done here to try to reach Native American populations and Latino populations. Understanding how window guards are important to injury prevention, that work is also done here. Smoke detectors and then violence and penetrating injury programs. And last year, work here resulted and was associated with passing of the distracted driving legislation, which we think is very important to keeping our public safe. The faculty here, we're very, as I mentioned, very interdisciplinary. We have 16 core faculty who spend the majority of their research efforts in topics that are important to injury prevention and control. We have 70 associate faculty, and these are faculty members across the University of Washington and even Washington State University and other institutions who are interested in partnering with us to address injury control-related topics. And this is a very important relationship that we have because we can draw on the large pool of experts to help us in the work that we do. We have 22 departments represented here and 7 schools, and those are listed on your slide to the right. As you can see, again, very interdisciplinary. And the disciplines here are listed just so that you can get a sense of that. Talked about this a little bit already. So what's important to us here is that we provide evidence-based research, and central to that is the existence of a robust methods core. And the methods core work involves rigorous scientific methodology, starting with hypothesis generation, strong and robust data collection, data analysis, data management, and then translating those findings for public consumption. So via not only publications in the publication realm, but also through dissemination to organizations such as yours so that research can be translated for improved public health. Just some examples here of transformative research that we've conducted and has been conducted by our faculty. and the impact that they've had. So Doug Zasik really studied, you know, introduction of a brief intervention for alcohol intervention in the emergency department, which has been associated with reduced readmission rates to the hospital. We've done work to try to understand how to streamline our imaging in the intensive care unit, and this has resulted in reduced imaging costs. We have developed a hospital-wide program for the care of children and adolescents with severe traumatic brain injury, and this has resulted in reduced conflict, improved communication, and provision of evidence-based care to these patients. Firearm violence research, Ali will be talking about this, so I will just say that this is really tremendous because it shows a robust partnership between the injury center and the trauma center where we're recruiting patients at the hospital. And we have a faculty member who's trying to understand nutrition in trauma patients, and because Harborview is such a has been such a great partner for the conduct of clinical research, this has been leveraged, and the faculty member has just received a large R01 to understand how to provide optimal nutrition for our injured patients for optimal outcomes. We also train future practitioners and researchers here at the center, and we do this via individualized research mentoring and career development mentoring. We have formal training programs here that begin with high school, with high school students, that includes undergraduates and graduate students, professional students, and then postdoctoral fellows. That part of that education is supported by an NIH T32 program, but we also have other fellows here who are supported by departments and other groups here at the University of Washington. We provide weekly works in progress sessions, monthly journal clubs, and that include method seminars. And this is really important because I think as, you know, clinicians, we really want to understand what the right way to conduct research is, and this partnership with our methodologists is critical. And we have partnerships and career development opportunities for public health professionals as well. As you can see on the slide here, we have a robust partnership with the Department of Health, and we conduct regular webinars that reach our public health practitioners and other clinicians. And if any of you is interested in participating in those, we have, we will be having them regularly this coming year on the topic of traumatic brain injury. We are Region 10 for TBI, and the DOH is very interested in reaching audiences in that topic. So we really subscribe to the notion of pipeline training, and this is why our training program begins with early students and really continues all across the trajectory of education. The goal really is to achieve injury control across the lifespan and related to health equity. These are just some photographs of our faculty who are involved in policy. The first photograph here is the passing of the distracted driving law with our governor, Jay Inslee, and this is Becky Bell here, who's a pediatrician who was instrumental in facilitating this work. This is Fred Rivara here, who's really led the effort nationwide and here around gun violence prevention, and this is a press conference with our mayor and city government. And this is Lieutenant Governor Cyrus Habib here. We went to Olympia to try to teach folks there around Stop the Bleed, which is, as most of you know, a national campaign to train the community around wound packing and tourniquet use. And a number of us participated in increasing awareness of the need to have Stop the Bleed kits in areas of high traffic, including the state legislature. We are active in our community outreach, and this is a partnership that we have with our hospitals. I won't read all of these to you, but they sort of map to our strengths and our focus areas. We have over 40 community partners with whom we engage. And this is just a poster that sort of shows the handshake, if you will, where we're at the center trying to facilitate conversations. We are in the process of developing a community advisory board that will include perspectives of the trauma center and also our community. So serving as a bridge in trying to understand what are the big problems the community wishes us to address from a research perspective that we can translate back to improving public health. If you'd like to visit our website, please do so at www.hiprc.org. You can learn a lot about the specific topic of specific area of violence prevention, but also other things that we do. And we do have a Twitter handle, those of you who are interested. So thank you very much for your time. I'm just going to pass this over to Fred Rivaro, who's going to talk about why hospitals should be involved with violence prevention.
Thanks very much, Dr. Corvalella. I'm going to try to set the stage for you about why, as hospitals, we should be involved with violence prevention. And then Dr. Rohani will talk with you about a intervention project which we have been working on for the last 2.5 years. So first of all, what do we mean by violence? Probably broader than you think. It certainly includes assaults, which can be fatal, i.e. homicides, non-fatal violence, which you certainly see in your hospital emergency departments, but it does include child abuse, it includes sexual assault and intimate partner violence, as well as elder abuse. But in the injury community, when we talk about violence, we also include suicide. Many of you may not think about that as part of the violence problem, but it certainly is. And it's important for you to realize that, you know, 65% of the deaths in the United States from firearms are suicides. And then finally, unintentional shootings, because we also consider those to be violence. Now, how big is the problem that we're facing? I'll first show you fatalities, and I'll show you a slide on hospitalizations and emergency department visits. So the last year for which the CDC provides data is 2016, which time there were about 20,000 homicides. 1,750 of those were child abuse, meaning that they were deaths in children under the age of 5. And 40% of female homicides are intimate partner violence homicides. And then there are 45,000 suicides and about 500 unintentional firearm injury deaths. So in terms of the overall magnitude of the problem, this is really quite large. As we all know, unfortunately, it's been overpassed in recent years by the opioid epidemic, but it still accounts for more deaths in opioid and motor vehicle crashes. In terms of what you might see in your hospitals, here is some data, again from 2016, on emergency department visits and hospitalizations. Assaults, 1.5 million emergency department visits and 140,000 of whom are hospitalized. Sexual assaults, a subcategory of assaults, about 88,000 emergency department visits. Many fewer of those are hospitalized. Child abuse is a really very large number of emergency department visits, and again, about 5,000 hospitalized. Now, those suicides account for a huge problem. Most of the serious suicide attempts actually die, but there are people that come in with less serious suicide attempts, 500,000 per year in emergency departments, of which 300,000 require hospitalization. Most people that come in with a serious suicide attempt are going to be hospitalized either at a acute care hospital or a psychiatric hospital. And then for gunshot wounds, 116,000 emergency department visits. And you can see that less than a third of those are hospitalized. Now, something that we all pay attention to is what are the costs of these kinds of injuries. And there are large costs of these. And I think what's important for you to see here is that $9 billion a year, but that's just medical care costs. If you look at work loss costs, they're three times larger in terms of $27 billion annually related to work-related costs, work loss time, productivity. Now, I want to share with you results of a study which really led us to do this violence prevention program that Dr. Rohani is going to talk about. So this was actually funded by the City of Seattle, which was the first jurisdiction in the country to provide funding for firearm-related research. As many of you probably know, the Dickey Amendment was passed in 1996, which essentially has forbidden the CDC from conducting and funding any firearm injury research. So the city of Seattle approached us after the massacre at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, and asked us to look at the amount of violence that we're seeing in our city and our state, and what are the risk factors for that violence, and what are the consequences of that violence. So what we did is we obtained statewide hospitalization data for the years 2006 and 2007, and then we went back and looked at hospitalization data for 5 years before and 5 years after the hospitalization, arrest data for 5 years before and 5 years after, conviction data 5 years before, 5 years after, and then deaths for the subsequent 5 years, to try to understand really what is going on and what's really the impact of these admissions that we're seeing in our hospitals for firearm-related injuries. One of the things we did is we compared those firearm-related hospitalizations to other hospitalizations. Some of those are violence-related, like assault and suicides. Some of those are accident-related. But then there's also a very large number of non-injury hospitalizations, people admitted for heart attacks or pneumonia or whatever. And what we find here is that over the subsequent 5 years, you can see that 25% of people admitted for a firearm injury are arrested in the next 5 years for a violent crime. About 18% of those that come in with assault-related injuries are arrested for a violent crime. So these are a very worrisome group of people that we want to try to do better in terms of helping. And then we look at what you all see in your hospitals is, well, how many of these people come back with another gunshot wound that requires hospitalization in the next 5 years? And you can see that more than 30% of these individuals who are admitted for a firearm injury come back in for another firearm injury over the next 5 years. So it really is kind of a major recidivism problem. And then finally, what about their risk of death? And you can see that those people who come in with a firearm injury over the next 5 years have an 11-fold increased risk of dying from a firearm injury over the next 5 years. So we began to think about what might we be able to do to prevent this kind of recidivism. And I want to share with you a study that Monica briefly mentioned that we did looking at the problem of alcohol and trauma. I think most of you know, particularly those of you who work in trauma centers, that on the order of 30 to 40% of trauma patients come in with acute alcohol intoxication. So we did a NIH-funded randomized controlled trial of doing one counseling session for brief intervention during the hospital stay. And you can see that 366 patients received the brief intervention and 396 received just usual trauma care. 74% of these people met DSM criteria for alcohol dependence, and the mean number of drinks they had per week was 44. So 6 to 7 drinks per day on average in this group of individuals. I want to emphasize that the intervention was really a very brief intervention using motivational interviewing to help people identify their alcohol problems and then refer them to outside services after their hospitalization for follow-up counseling. It was done by a PhD-level psychologist in our hospital. And here I show you a first number of reduction in drinking, and then after that I'll show you the reduction in recidivism. But you can see here is that for the intervention group, the black line, is that the intervention group had on average, 21 drinks per week reduction in the amount of drinking they did from baseline. Now, that doesn't mean that they were completely sober, because the mean number was 42 to begin with, but they really reduced the amount of drinking by half. The standard care group, the usual care group, at 6 months were better But then by 12 months, they actually were back drinking as much, if not more, than they were at the time of their initial injury. So the intervention really had a dramatic effect on the amount of drinking that these individuals did. And what was really important here was looking at the effects of this on rehospitalization at our trauma hospital over the next year. And you can see that the brief intervention group had a much lower risk of being readmitted to a hospital than the standard care group. This is kind of survival curves here. They had a 47% reduction in re-injury over the next year. So we cut the amount of drinking in half, and we cut the risk of readmission in half. And what we also did a cost-effectiveness analysis, and we showed that for every dollar spent on doing a screening and intervention, the personnel that we had to hire to do this intervention, we saved the hospital $3.81. And this is not savings to the society on a whole. This is savings to the hospital from prevention of recidivism. So the point of it is that a brief intervention done at a trauma center can have a major impact upon something like drinking among trauma patients. And then we use this really to go to the next level. Dr. Ohani will talk with you now about the randomized trial we're doing for violence prevention.
Thank you, Dr. Rivera. My name is Ali Rahani, and I will be talking to you about an ongoing randomized trial that we are conducting at Harborview Medical Center, as was mentioned before. We are in the midst of conducting this study, so I'm delighted to share with you some of the major elements of this study for your information. Once the study is over in the next couple of years, obviously, we will share the results of this ongoing effort here. As some of you may know, as part of the efforts, national and local efforts in violence prevention at the hospital setting or hospital-based violence prevention programs, the wraparound programs for trauma patients at healthcare settings have existed for about 2 decades. But it wasn't until 2009 when the National Network of Hospital-Based Violence Intervention Programs was actually formally formed. And the idea with these programs is to employ trauma-informed care at the teachable moment to interrupt the costly cycle of violent injury, essentially by transforming medical treatment into a catalyst for positive life changes. So I assume many of you are familiar with this concept. You may have programs in your centers, or you may have heard about some of these programs in other centers. The reality, though, is that while we do have several of these programs around the country, research on the effectiveness of these programs is critically needed to build robust empirical support for policy and practice, to really provide that evidence that these programs work, under what circumstances they may work better, and as Dr. Rivera mentioned, what are the cost implications of these programs in different settings around the country. So we proposed to conduct a study entitled HIFI, Helping Individuals with Firearm Injuries, which is one of the more unique studies around the country. The background about what motivated us to do this was provided by Dr. Rivera after that large statewide study that showed really individuals who get shot and they get hospitalized are at increased risk of getting shot and getting murdered again, and this is really important to not only quantify but also measure what kind of prevention can be done to prevent this recidivism. So it's an ongoing RCT right now conducted among gunshot wound patients at Harborview Medical Center. The way that we have conceived of this study is to conduct a randomized trial in which calendar weeks are the unit of randomization. So all gunshot wound patients who come to Harborview Medical Center on certain weeks, they receive the usual care. And the other half who come to Harborview Medical Center during the intervention weeks, they receive the intervention, which I will share with you shortly. This is the schematic of the enrollment and follow-up, which is pretty simple. We started this enrollment, as Dr. Rivera mentioned, back in 2016 with funding again from the City of Seattle. We augmented that funding with some funds from the Laura and John Arnold Foundation, and we currently have funding for 2019 as well to finish the follow-up, at least 1 year of follow-up for patients who were enrolled, as you can see in the on this slide, some patients who were enrolled earlier, obviously they can be followed up longer. The intervention that we are proposing consists of three different components: motivational interviewing, very much like the one that Dr. Rivera mentioned in the context of that earlier alcohol and trauma-related study, is essentially a pre-CTI or pre-critical time intervention phase where our support specialist or case manager, who is an MSW-trained person, approaches these patients at the bedside and talks to them to create a rapport, but also mention the importance of connection to the second component of this study, which is of the intervention, which is CTI. CTI stands for critical time intervention. We had several conversations with our colleagues in school of social work and those around the country who have done this type of work. Critical time intervention is a type of intervention that's supposed to help individuals who are at a very critical time in their life transition from, let's say, unstable housing to stable housing, transition from hospital setting to the community setting. This intervention can take any time from 6 to 9 months. So it requires a sustained level of effort by a case manager or support specialist who works with these patients to ensure that they have access to things such as education, employment, housing, substance use treatment, mental health treatment, etc. And we have a multidisciplinary team of community stakeholders, including colleagues in law enforcement, mental health and substance use treatment facilities, those who work in educational sector, those who work in employment sector and housing sector. So those are all represented on our multidisciplinary team. And their job really is to help our case manager or support specialist to help these patients navigate this somewhat fragmented environment that they face once they are released from the hospital in terms of addressing their needs. This is a more detailed version of the CTI, or critical time intervention. As I mentioned, the motivational interviewing, which is brief, and its goal is to really connect the patients to CTI, is done at the bedside ideally, or at the clinic, or hospital ED, depending on the patient's clinical situation and condition. And that is really meant to develop a trusting relationship with patients. Then the patients go through phases. Phase one is transition, when they are provided with support and begin to connect to people and agencies that will assume primary role of support for them in whatever area of need that they identify, whether it's housing or substance use treatment or employment, etc. Phase two is tryout, when the support specialist monitor and strengthen support network and patient skill. And essentially tapering off in phase three is the transfer of care, where the support specialist terminates CTI and let the individual, the patient himself or herself, take over once those processes of care and support are established. So you may ask, we are doing this intervention, what are we measuring in terms of outcome? What are we trying to improve? Well, we are fortunate to have access to a variety of different administrative databases here, which are really important, because not only is it important to focus on self-report and these surveys, which is important, it's really important to hear from patients themselves how they feel, what is their level of depression, what is their level of PTSD, but also it's important to look at administrative databases such as those from the criminal justice system, such as arrest and convictions, healthcare utilization, so statewide hospitalization data and ED data, and then information on things such as mental health, depression, post-traumatic stress, substance use, life satisfaction, social support, quality of life, and exposure to violence. Obviously, this is an individual-based intervention. We cannot change systems. That would be a very lofty goal that we can't achieve. So when these individuals go back to their post dose, at least they respond a little bit better. So as you could imagine, as you're listening to this, I imagine you're thinking about challenges of this type of work and rewards. So there are challenges that we have faced over the past 2.5 years. There is no question about that. Some of them, maybe the main ones, I have depicted here. One of them is obviously the issue of cost. So ideally, with this type of work, because you never know who gets shot when, and this is a 24/7 type of work, we may receive patients at Harborview Medical Center at any time over the week. So having sufficient study staff to attend to these patients is really important. The good news, however, as Dr. Rivera mentioned, is that we do have evidence, very solid evidence from the literature, that this does translate into saving costs, not only for the hospital, but also for the society at large. And the cost saving for something like violence for the hospital actually could be really large. There are studies that show that this could range from $500,000 to $2 or $3 or $4 million for a small cohort of 180 or 200 gunshot wound victims, so which is a really, really major cost saving. So that does exist. So the cost, the upfront of having personnel will be offset, more than offset, by the savings that will happen later on by preventing violence. The other one is the issue of poverty, socioeconomic position or socioeconomic status. Many of our individuals live in poverty. They have very, very low income. So in terms of transportation, they have difficulties. In terms of the address change, they don't have a stable housing. They do, they go from this location to another location. They are homeless, so they don't have really stable housing. It is our responsibility as part of this program to really try to provide them with vouchers to be able to facilitate their transportation, try to facilitate meeting with them in the hospital clinics or the satellite rooms that are available here around the center to make sure that we get to meet them and work with them. Lastly, I would say this is a population that displays what's called systems avoidance. They do have some level of distrust for institutions. They have apprehension of authorities. So it's really important for the support specialist, the person who is doing this job, to have lived experience or at least be familiar with the environment that these individuals have experienced, to be able to talk to them, their language, to be able to communicate with them, connect with them, and really understand their pain and trauma truly through a trauma-informed care approach. So I will wrap up in the next minute or so. I just want to conclude by saying that with sufficient support, this work, we have shown that it is feasible and quite rewarding. Sometimes we hide behind numbers, and we look at numbers, it's not so easy to see some of these contextual things that come up through qualitative work, and actually we are about to start a qualitative assessment of our work very soon. But I have listed some of these sentences that you see here. I would have no clue what to do without you. I didn't even know these services exist. The counselor you referred us to is great and has been making a huge difference. I wish there were more programs like this. So those are the type of quotes that keep us going. And I think raising awareness about hospital-based violence intervention programs is our collective responsibility. These are programs that are in need of financial support, and they can go a long way in terms of saving costs for all those involved in the hospital and beyond. So enhanced communication among those involved in the implementation and evaluation of these programs is vital. We need to do continued advocacy to harness additional sources for funding and really try to collectively, positively impact lives of those people who are affected by this epidemic. So with that, I will
take questions.
Any questions you have?
Thank you so much to the three of you for presenting this amazing program. Let's take a pause here and open the call for questions and comments. Chelsea, if you would please instruct everybody how to do that.
Yes, ma'am. You can either chat or type your question in the Adobe chat, or you can press star 1 on your telephone keypad to ask your question via the phone.
And while we're waiting, I'll kick us off. We've had a few. Well, first of all, let me say we've had several requests for the slides, so I'd like to let everybody know we will be sending those with a feedback form after the presentation. And we've also had some inquiries about what would be a good starting point for a smaller hospital or institution to start a program like yours. And in addition, if you could add some details, how you really started, and did you have a champion?
I guess maybe some clarity. Are you talking about the violence prevention program specifically or the injury center overall?
Both, if you could tell us about that.
So maybe I'll start off by talking about the injury center work and then actually how the violence prevention program is a natural part of it and an extension of it. And I think it's, In the state of Washington, it's there's sort of a law requirement that says that a level one trauma center should have an injury control unit, and
that's actually activity, part of the criteria for
designation.
Call it a surgeon.
Yeah.
As well.
But the size and scope of it really varies across the country, and there are hospitals that have injury control centers that are, you know, limited to one or two topics, and there are those that that are broader. So I think the first step, regardless of the size, is to sort of identify, you know, the topic that's of interest, in this case, a violence prevention program, and really try to get some experts in the area to try to serve as the content experts on the data end, folks who can work to evaluate the data that's collected, create robust data collection systems, and then partner with the hospital negotiate for resources to try to evaluate whatever program that is in place. I think regular conversations that address the hospital's needs, the community needs, are really critical for whatever injury control center that exists to be successful, because what we really want to do here is do real world research. And so I think it really has to be viewed as a partnership that meets the needs of the public and the patients who are seen at the hospital that is considering developing such a program. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Rohani.
So I echo what Dr. Vagulala mentioned in terms of the bigger umbrella of having a trauma center, a research center like this that would pave the way for actually conducting a program like HIFI I mentioned to you. Without the injury center, obviously, we would not have been able to conduct HIFI. I would say, in answer to your question about how to start, where to start, which is a really good question, two things come to my mind. One is try to collect data locally, even if it's just pilot data, locally in your setting, in your hospital catchment area, to provide some basis, some evidence on the impact of violence in that setting, whether it's the burden on the hospital, the number of patients who are violently injured and come to the ED or get hospitalized, because that evidence is needed, just like the study that Dr. Rivera explained, that really is needed to essentially pave the way for conducting an intervention or starting a program like this. Secondly, I would really encourage you to go online and check the website of the National Network of Hospital-Based Violence Intervention Programs. The National Network actually has a really nice and detailed book or booklet, a PDF, that's available for free online that essentially provides step-by-step from day one, as you just asked, where to even start, how to start a program like this. And your hospital can, your center can actually become a member of the National Network if there is political will in your setting, in that institution. So I think there is a wealth of information there that you could use to jumpstart the program.
Great, thank you. That's very helpful. I'll pause and ask Chelsea if anyone would like to ask a live question or has any comments.
No, ma'am. As of right now, there are not any questions in the queue. Again, that's star one to ask a question.
Thank you. We've had one about community partnerships. How are these made and cultivated? And what is the, have you received any negative feedback from the community?
Ali, do you want to take that for your program?
From my program? Okay, sure. So I will take it from more narrow perspective for HIFI, for this program, and then I will let Dr. Vagulala talk about a much broader umbrella of community engagement for the entire center. I would say for the gunshot wound patient intervention program, I start with your second question. I personally have not received any major or notable negative feedback or comments from people in the community or among colleagues. We have been supported by many around us, and people feel that this is really important work that needs to be done. Going back to your actually previous question about champions, I would say we've also been fortunate that there are champions around, both from the, you know, the city of Seattle that provided this funding for us, and at the hospital level, who believe in the importance of this type of work. In terms of community engagement, we started very early on. We identified in each sector, whether it's the law enforcement or housing or education, employment, through conversations with colleagues, we started contacting these individuals very early on and asked them about their interest in getting involved in this type of work. Of course, the answers varied. Some of them were more willing to participate and available. Some of them were not. But overwhelmingly, they were also very positive. So one by one, we discussed this study, this program with them. We provide evidence about our earlier study that Dr. Rivara mentioned, and once they were told about that and they heard about the impact of potential impact of such program, many of them were on board. I would just end by saying that I would encourage early initiation of these conversations, because they need to be in place before the program starts. So now I'll let Dr. Rivara talk about that.
One of the other projects that the Injury Center has been a partner with has been with the Seattle Children's Hospital on a gun lockbox giveaway program. This is a program that where we go to sporting goods stores that sell firearms and actually give away free trigger locks or lock boxes. As you can imagine, that there are some people at Children's that were concerned about, is this really the hospital's bailiwick to do? And so they actually surveyed a number of groups. They surveyed their board of trustees, they surveyed their patient council, and they surveyed their donors. And uniformly, almost unanimously, everyone thought that that was within the purview of the hospital to do. So I think one of the things you can look at, if you are of any concern about that, is to do similar kinds of surveys. Ask your board of trustees, ask your donors, ask your patient council, do they think that a hospital being involved with XYV program, whether it be a gun lock box giveaway or a violence intervention program, is that really an appropriate thing for the hospital to do? And I think you'll probably be pleasantly surprised that most people would greatly support it.
Thank you. I was going to ask you, so when you founded the center early on, maybe you could speak a little bit to the early community engagement and how you developed your initial stakeholder group, and then I can talk about more recently.
Well, I think we tried to pick projects that were going to be successful. So one of the earliest that we worked on was bicycle helmets. And so we really partnered there with the American Academy of Pediatrics, private physicians, American Academy of Family Medicine, hospitals within the community, police, the Seattle Police Department, Transportation Department, and we really found a very open, receptive audience to try to partner with us with everyone viewed as an important public health problem, namely preventing serious traumatic brain injury, and offering a decent solution, a feasible solution that families, parents, individual bicyclists could adopt. And I think picking a project that is a winner to begin with is probably pretty important before you pick something that may be a little bit more controversial.
So when I became the director here 3 years ago, you know, it was actually not that hard to sort of reach out to our community here because of the work that Fred and others have done. I think the stakeholder engagement has grown for us over the past 3 years. Our community, the number of community organizations who are interested in working with us has really grown. And this is because we, I think, have committed to providing data to sort of back up the claims that we make. And community organizations are increasingly relying on health systems to provide evidence behind the care or the policies that we make. And they're sort of partnering with us to sort of share the message and communicate to constituents as to why certain public health behaviors are important or not. So our partners range from nonprofits to local medical directors to the Department of Health to groups such as, you know, Violence Against Women and other parties. And we have been in conversation over the last year with the mayor's office, the governor's office, and so we've sort of become a group that they rely on when they need sort of evidence and expert commentary. So I think for us, because we're linked with the University of Washington here and have a large number of faculty members, you know, the individual faculty have reached out to groups that they think are important to moving the work forward. And so as a collective, we have a large number of diverse groups. The Somali Health Board is an example of a recent partner who we are working with to try to increase engagement so that their use of the emergency medical services, you know, the ambulance service, the 911 service, to increase their engagement and trust. And we're doing that by working with their health board. So I think it's been successful because the community members are using their health boards as conduits to engage with our health systems, and the hospitals are learning increasingly about how to meet the needs of those populations. So it's really been a very mutually beneficial relationship.
Monica, what percentage of the hospitals, you know, sort of TV media presence is due to the injury center versus other issues at the hospital?
I don't have the exact answer to that question, but I can tell you that over the past year, we have, our work at the Injury Center and partnership with the hospital has been valued at $12 million. And that's, and the investment that the system has made in us is much less than that. I mean, we're very grateful for that piece, but I think the point we're trying to make here is that there's been a lot of recognition for the positive work and impact that we've made here in the sphere of injury control. And the fact that the hospital system partners with us is really a lot, there's a lot of press for the health system because of the work that we do.
I think it's probably a pretty rare week that one of us or one of the other members of the Injury Center has not spoken to the press about a topic.
That's true. In fact, last week we were interviewed, I was interviewed by Reuters on looking, you know, trying to comment on some of the work done by the University of Pennsylvania on concussions. And really, it has to do with study design and methodology. And so, you know, because our injury center has the name Harborview attached to it, the hospital system really does benefit, we think.
Building on the hospital, we've had a question come in. It says, can you explain the nature of cost savings to the hospital? Was the hospital providing unreimbursed care?
Was your question pertaining to the HIFI program specifically or generally?
The alcohol program.
Yeah, the alcohol program.
I think the general partnership.
So I think, you know, so Harborview Medical Center is King County owned and it's run by the University of Washington. And so the faculty who oversee medical care at the trauma center are all faculty at the University of Washington. And so because when we participate in research that addresses reducing unnecessary imaging, for example, with bundled payments, we are really reducing costs to the hospital for unnecessary performance of CT scans or x-rays, for example. So that's one concrete example of cost savings to the hospital when they partner with us to conduct research that's directly relevant to the care of injured patients.
We also know that the Harborview is the largest provider of unreimbursed care in the state. And so I think from prevention of repeat visits by gunshot wound patients, assault victims, patients with alcohol problems who are much less likely to have health insurance does end up saving the hospital money. And, you know, and I think that the hospital's interested in that. The state is also interested in that. You know, we did a study a number of years ago looking at the problem that we had before, of not having a motorcycle helmet law here, and found out that two-thirds of the care provided to injured motorcyclists by Harborview was either unreimbursed or government-funded care. The state legislature used that information to pass a motorcycle helmet law that year.
And I would just add, echoing what Dr. Bavilotta and Rivera mentioned, many of these conditions, as you know, the whole concept of trauma, we think about trauma as a recurrent disease, as a chronic condition that many of these individuals, especially those who have been affected by violence, they come back over and over and over again. Some of them may come back for 20 or 30 times in the course of a few years. So when you consider about issues that Dr. Rivera mentioned around insurance and the cost to the hospital, it translates into massive numbers in terms of saving for the hospital.
There was a clarification that says, what about savings from the HIFI program?
So we haven't calculated that yet. As I mentioned, we are in the midst of this study, so I hope that we'll have some of those numbers starting 2020, because as I mentioned, the end of the follow-up will be the end of 2019. So we would expect that some of the early results of the program will emerge sometime in 2020. That will be based on the effectiveness of the program on one hand, at the same time, the cost that went into the implementation of the program and the estimated cost that was prevented because of reduction of recidivism.
And just also remember that there's the acute medical care costs, but there's also longer-term medical care costs, as well as the criminal justice costs. I think the criminal justice costs for violence usually far outweighs the acute medical care costs.
It does. By several fold, the criminal justice system involvement will outweigh the medical costs.
Thank you. I think let's take another pause. And Chelsea, any live questions or comments?
No, ma'am, not right now.
Well, this takes us almost to the top of the hour, and we always promise to start and finish within an hour so that you'll come back and join us. I want to thank you so much for participating on today's call. I'd like to thank our presenters, Dr. Vavi Lala, Dr. Rivara, and Dr. Rawani Rabar, and Harriet Sachs. And thank you also to Jamel Ola, who helped plan and organize the call. And we welcome and appreciate your feedback on today's webinar. So immediately following this call, you'll receive an email requesting your comments, if you would please fill that out. And we'll continue our series of calls and webinars in 2019, on a range of topics, so please look for those. And visit us at aha.org for additional information. We will be archiving this. And if you have questions, please don't let them stop here. We can put you in touch with our speakers, any questions or comments. But thank you all for joining, and a happy Friday. We are adjourned.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.